Israel, reading this would force you to that conclusion. This is not divisions of the church. The church is never referred to as Israel. The church is referred to as the church, Ecclesia. From the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000. From the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000. From the tribe of Simeon, 12,000. From the tribe of Levi, 12,000. From the tribe of Issachar, 12,000. And from the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000. From the tribe of Joseph, 12,000. From the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000. Again, present passive, or a perfect passive participle, were being sealed. And the perfect participle is in the Greek, the tense that tells you there's existing results to this, that it's not, quote, they're being sealed, bam, and then nothing happens, that there are existing results to this seal. And as we pointed out, the seal is designed to be one of ownership. This was very common in the ancient world, and protection. Those are the two primary things. But seals also in the ancient world denoted things like allegiance and various other factors. And the thing we see with these 12,000, or each 12,000 from each tribe, is that at the end of all, they have been faithful. Their allegiance is unquestioned. They are called blameless because they have not failed in their task. And their task is to represent God in the world and the true plan of God, and because it's going to get very weird. I mean, Satan's going to be countering it. He's going to be espousing all kinds of explanations for why Christians disappeared off the planet. He's got to come up with an answer for that. And I'm sure he's already got a plan. Satan, if anything, he's resourceful. You got to give him that one. Okay, so we had just started into this. Let's pick up here at point four. As one interpreter noted, the use of Israel, who is the father of the 12 tribes, coupled with the 12 historical descendants of Jacob, makes the context scream against such a conclusion, and that is the conclusion that this is anything other than literal Jews. If you're intellectually honest, this comment sums it up. It screams against any other interpretation. You have to wrench the text and destroy it incredibly to make it say something else. Five, the one debated passage, again, as we pointed out, that is often cited to document the position that this is the church, is Galatians 6:16, which is actually designed to distinguish only between believing Gentiles and believing Jews. And there is a distinction. I mean, in the church, we're all the same positionally, but certainly we recognize that there are still racial distinctions out there, that Jews exist, that Gentiles exist, etc. Six, it should come as no surprise that the emphasis is now back on the Jewish nation, since a careful study of the scriptures reveals regarding the Jews reveals the primary purposes of Daniel's 70th week are the humbling, refining, and restoration of the remnant of Israel. And all those verses there teach that Israel has got to be humbled. Number one, Israel is arrogant at this point. That's part of their problem. They do not fully rely on their God. They have rejected their God. They have rejected his plan as set forth in Messiah. And of course, that is what is necessary in order to have salvation. It's not enough just to believe in God. Generally speaking, all Jews believe in God. But they're not saved. Why? Because the issue is not God and belief in him. The issue is faith in Messiah. And Jesus taught that repeatedly when he was here at the first Advent. That if you don't believe in me, if you don't accept the fact that I am God, they understood he was human. There was no issue there. But the issue was he God? And the fact is, he was. He was the God-man, the unique person of all the universe. Well, seven, it is not necessary that all or even most of these 144,000 come from the present state of Israel. There is nothing in the passage about the geographical region in which this group is sealed. So I guess I had kind of always thought, this was one little new twix in my thinking, was that I guess I kind of always had them pictured as being sealed in Israel. But then it dawned on me as I was studying this, there's nothing that says where they are on the planet. And logic would further tend to confirm that these 144,000 are going to be all over the globe. They're not going to be confined to one geographic area, which does several things. Number one, it explains why the four winds of the earth all had to be held back. Because the whole implication of that is that the whole globe is being protected for some time. Now, however long that is, it's not too long as we know. But the fact is that the whole globe is being protected, which indicates, logically you would think, that there are these Jews out there all over the place. Second thing it does is that these Jews are all going to speak the natural language wherever they are. And this obviously allows them great freedom in presenting the gospel and the other issues of the plan of God with respect to Daniel's 70th week. And as we have pointed out, that positive volition can make significant spiritual strides when they are thrown into tremendous testing and pressure. And if their level of positive volition is such that they actually want to do this, and they do, first class condition in the Greek, then they are going to spiritually, I mean, they're going to put things together quickly. I mean, very quickly, probably quicker than church age believers have. They're going to realize that they're right in the middle of this thing. And I mean, they're literally, their manual, their handbook is going to be the Bible. And in a way, obviously, in which it is not right now. Because by and large, the Jews tend to reject the New Testament as a whole. And so it won't just be the Old Testament, but they will figure out certain things like those passages there in Isaiah and Jeremiah that tell them to be the leaders on getting people out of America. And this explains, of course, why America is never mentioned in all this. The greatest, most powerful nation in the last days. You go through all this and you say, well, where were they? Well, we'll deal with them. They are here, but we have to look at it. So again, they're all over the globe, and that only makes sense to me that they would be. This would further, of course, help them to be able to deal with what they have to deal with. Eighth, the fact that the angel who announces the sealing of the 144,000 gives his message to the four angels at the corners of the earth. And again, as we pointed out, I like to ridicule the wooden-headed literalist. I can't help it. It's one of my weaknesses, so bear with me. There aren't four corners of the earth. We know that. This is not scientific language. But we do understand the compass points. We understand directions. And we understand which way is north and south and east and west. And so the globe is round. So in a sense, I mean, obviously there aren't any corners at all. So this isn't designed to be scientific. It's an idiom. It's a common idiom that people still use. Really, to be honest with you, there aren't any, quote, compass points either. But that's the way it goes. Nine, this leads to the logical conclusion that the 144,000 are not confined to a particular geographic region, but are scattered all over the world. Ten, given the present widespread distribution of the Jewish people and the clear necessity for the audience of the 144,000 to receive their messages in their own languages, it only makes sense to conclude that these Jews will reside all over the planet. 11, having documented that these 144,000 are Jewish, it should be understood that they have a unique ministry during a unique time of history. I mean, all of this smacks of uniqueness. They're sealing, the fact that these angels are holding back judgment on their behalf, the fact that there's a specific number of them. I mean, this whole passage screams about uniqueness. And, of course, it is in during a unique period of history, as we know. 12, as one interpreter has noted, the need to understand the Jewish point of view and avoid giving offense will be one of the unique purposes for this group. One of the challenges that the early church faced, and we saw this a great deal when we studied the book of Acts, was the deal of how to deal with the Jews. The Jews were God's people, but they were being set aside. And certain believers very early on recognized that. Stephen was one of those very forward-thinking believers that was able to put things together at a level maybe I don't think even the apostles did. So the apostles had the authority, they had the rank, but that doesn't mean they understood everything perfectly. And Stephen, in his great speech there in Acts chapter 7, demonstrates a real knowledge of the fact that Jerusalem was not the only place you could worship God, and that God's ministry was literally worldwide. But now that went against a number of things. One, it went against the primary fundamental Jewish point of view that God was for Israel and Israel only. And that was true up to a point. But it also went against, of course, as we saw, the established leadership and their cash cow. And that temple in Jerusalem was a cash cow. And this was one of the things that Jesus pointed out when he was here at the first Advent, was that he wasn't too impressed with the fact that his house of prayer had become a cash cow for these people. And so he went in and he overturned the money changers' tables because they had several gimmicks in which they were scamming people. Unfair rates of exchange, for instance. The fact that you could only buy animals there. You couldn't bring your animals in, per se. They had all kinds of things going on that allowed them to make exorbitant profits. So the issue became in the early church, how are we going to deal with this now? Israel has always been God's people. We all know that. But now how are we going to deal with this change? Well, In one sense, this group will be very well equipped to handle any of those issues because they are Jewish themselves. No one will be able to accuse them of being anti-Semites. And that, of course, is a very rampant thought system on this planet now and will continue to be. Anti-Semitism is only going to continue to increase. But because they are Jewish, and they will apparently be able to trace their heritage. I mean, these tribes aren't mentioned, in my opinion, accidentally. They're going to be able to trace their heritage on all of this and show that they are Jewish. No one's going to be able to accuse them of anti-Semitism while they tell the Jews, and of course part of their job is to call the Jews to recovery. That's going to be one of their jobs, is to call in the two witnesses. That will be their job primarily too. But they seem to be more confined to the nation of Israel. Well, 13, some have suggested that their ministry will be largely confined to the Jews, but there is nothing in any of the passages about them that suggests this. In fact, the massive group of believers from all nationalities are intimately connected with the 144,000 by context. And if you look in verse 9 and following, the question becomes, who is this large group? Why is it mentioned here? And what is the significance of this as related to what just happened, the 144,000? After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could count. A very cosmopolitan multitude from every nation and all tribes and tongues and peoples, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes and palm branches were in their hands. And they cry out with a loud voice. And so the question becomes, one might ask, who are these people? And John didn't know. John obviously wouldn't know, because this was in some ways outside his frame of reference. And one of the elders, verse 13, answered. Answered who? See, the implied thing is here that John had asked a question. We're not told that, but the text says he answered him, saying to me, those who are clothed in the white robes, who are they? And my suspicion is it was an unspoken question. And that's why it's not recorded in the text. John was sitting there scratching his head in a sense, who are these people? And the angel answered, or one of the elders answered, who are they and where are they come from? And I said to him, my Lord, you know. That was his nice way of saying, I don't have a clue. And he said to me, these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation. And they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. I mean, the imagery here is, of course, one that just screams against literalism. You don't wash anything in blood and make it white. And so the blood of the Lamb, of course, refers to his person, particularly his work on the cross. The spiritual sacrifice of Christ that procured salvation as a potential for all men. So who are these people? Well, this indicates, in some senses, where do these people come from? How do they get the message and all that? Well, that's the context here of the 144,000. In many cases, they got it from them. So 14, some have further suggested that they will be empowered to perform miracles, which may be true, but they assert this with no supporting documentation. Now, will these 144,000 be able to do miraculous things to counteract the miracles that the false prophet and the Antichrist are going to be able to do? Well, we certainly know that the two witnesses will, because they're able to smite the earth with various plagues. But there isn't anything that suggests these 144,000 will at this point that I could see. Now, 15, the one prophetic passage that might indicate that their ministry may have a supernatural element is the prophecy in Joel 2:28-32. A prophecy, of course, that we've had occasion to look at quite a few times because it is directly related to the context of the day of the Lord. Joel 2:28. And it will come about after this, I will pour out my spirit on all mankind. And your sons and your daughters will prophesy, and your old men will dream dreams, and your young men will see visions. Now, in that, in a sense, there's not, quote, any powers of doing miracles mentioned. But certainly there is a supernatural impact to what he's saying here. And even on the male and female servants, I will pour out my spirit in those days. And we know that this passage, of course, is confined or deals with the period known just prior to the day of the Lord. And I will display wonders in the sky and on the earth, a blood, fire, and columns of smoke. One of the things that we have seen, certainly in the last 10 years anyway, is a number of celestial phenomena that are in very many ways unique. We've seen a number of amazing conjunctions. We've seen planets being closer than they ever have at some time, and These sorts of things are designed to get people's attention. I mean, it's like God's up there, knock, 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 here I am, pay attention. Blood, fire, and columns of smoke. Now, we know when that's going to happen. And the sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. So, again, here, this passage doesn't particularly say they're going to be able to do miracles, but you could, from this, I guess, maybe suggest that they will have some sort of supernatural element to their ministry. But again, overt miracles, it doesn't, quote, say so. So when it doesn't say so, well, then we just have to leave it at that. And that's a part of having to deal with the text intellectually, honestly. You can't just make some big assertion that you have not one verse to back up and then say, well, it has to be true. And people have done that. We call that popery. That's what the Pope does. He makes these big pronouncements, even though they may not be biblical, and they become Catholic law. Well, 16, we now move to the problematic area of these verses, which deals with the listing of the 12 tribes and the order in which they are recorded. 17, there is no list in either the Old or New Testament that uses this exact order, although the 20 or so lists in the Bible disagree quite remarkably from one another. But the order is similar to the matriarchal birth order. And that is, the birth order is given through the mom. Which woman had, and as we know, these children all did not come from one mother. In fact, there were several involved. Well, 18, it is clear that this list is unique and does not correspond with any of the other lists, such as the land grant list. Now, that was in say, Joshua's time, where they were dividing up the land of Israel that God had given to his people. And that was a part of the Abrahamic covenant. That covenant is still, by the way, of course, as we know, in force and effect. And so the Abrahamic covenant promised the Jews that land. That is their land. The Palestinians can say whatever they want. That is God's land. He created it, and he has the right to dispense it as he sees fit. And he determined that that land was going to be his people, the 12 tribes of Israel. And so people may argue about that. They may say the Jews have no right to be there, when in fact they have every right to be there. And that's another part of the subtle anti-Semitism that pervades the world. That the Jews are the cause of the problems in the Middle East. No, they're not. Yeah, they have this arrogant stupidity that says to them that their land is their land. Well, how awful. You wouldn't want people doing that all the time. This is my land. God gave it to me. I mean, but we have this going on all the time. People act as though the Jews are at the root of all of this. They're not. But God also said, one of the prophecies in the Old Testament was, I'm going to make Jerusalem a burdensome stone to the nations. And he's telling everybody ahead of time, people are going to get sick and tired of you people, and Jerusalem is going to come the focal point of many, many attacks, such as we have seen and are only going to continue to intensify, as we know. So again, the land grant list, that's recorded, say, in the older passages, back around the time of Joshua, and that occurred circa 1400 B.C. If you go back and do the chronology of the Old Testament, the Jews came out of Egypt 1445 to 1446 B.C. And this is part of the problem, of course, with modern Egyptology and the chronologies based on that, is they don't even have the dynasties in the right place because they don't have the Exodus in the right place. And if you put the Exodus in the right place, it explains a lot about Egyptian history. I mean, it explains tons of things. It explains why the Hyksos, those shepherd kings, came in and took over, because the nation had been devastated. And you put all that in the right place, and suddenly the chronology of Egypt does make sense. But the problem is, they're off in many cases 200, 300, 400 years, and they have all these anomalies and these chronological problems that they can't figure out why they exist. Well, one thing, they don't have the Exodus dated right. And to show you again, to give you an example of the intellectual dishonesty of many of these people that work over there and do the research, Kathleen Kenyon, if you happen to know that name, was one of the great archaeologists that worked over there. And she excavated Jericho. And if you know anything about the Bible, you know that Jericho was one of the first cities they took. And it was, in fact, the most fortified city of the Canaanite cities. It sets up on a hill, and it was surrounded completely by walls, and it was impenetrable. And that's the whole story there in Joshua, that it was impenetrable by human means. And so Kathleen Kenyon excavates Jericho, finds that the walls have fallen outward. Huh, strangely enough, just like the Bible said. And because it was on a hill, I mean, the stuff as they fell just went down the hill. And she found it just in the state the Bible described, said, well, this couldn't be the destruction under Joshua because this is 200 years out of date. Well, wait a minute, why not just suggest that it is the destruction under Joshua and date it from that? That's the intellectual dishonesty of these people. And many of them are believers. Go figure. But they have this axe to grind about their chronology, and they view the Egyptian chronology as being the sacred cow that no one dare question. Well, guess what? One guy did question it. Donovan Courville was the first one. And he demonstrated conclusively, to my thinking, that they were all way off. And if you date these things from the Bible, everything here fits and makes perfect sense. But that's the problem. If you look at history through some skewed vision, you're going to see it in a skewed fashion. So again, it is clear here this list is unique and does not correspond with any of the other lists, such as the land grant list, which would exclude Joseph and Levi, nor is the list based on strict paternity. In other words, Manasseh is not Jacob's son. He's Joseph's son. So why is he in the list? And for instance, say Dan is not. Well, 19, the matriarchal birth order of birth is as follows. Leah gave birth to Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Rachel gave birth to Joseph and Benjamin. Zilpah gave birth to Gad and Asher, and Bilhah gave birth to Dan and Naphtali. The biological and chronological order of birth is this. Reuben was the first. Reuben, behold the son, is the firstborn. Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. Now that's the birth order, chronologically. Reuben being the oldest, of course, and Benjamin being the youngest. 21, the order in Revelation is Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin, which doesn't correspond with any of these other lists. So 22, this list clearly reflects some differences as to who is included and the order in which they're listed. 23, the first difficulty is that Judah is first and not Simeon. That, in my opinion, is not hard to reconcile. But most recognize that this is based on the fact that Messiah came from this tribe, thus elevating its status. Genesis 49:10, where Jacob gives this great prophecy about his sons. And one of the things we see is that Judah under the law of primogeniture, if you're familiar with that, which was the right of the firstborn. And the firstborn in the patriarchal societies had a number of things. Number one, he got a double portion. And he was the heir. And so stood to inherit primarily what his father had. And certain people, say for instance, as we know, Esau was negative. He wasn't interested in God or his plan. And so he forfeited his right as firstborn, although he was the firstborn. Spiritually, if people could be disqualified from this, then Esau is a case in point. Well, it appears also that Simeon, because of some of his actions, was disqualified from this. And Judah took his place. Genesis 49:10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Nor the lawgiver, literally, or ruler from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. Now, of course, this is not an easy passage. I don't claim it's an easy passage. Going through it in the Hebrew didn't help me particularly a lot. But it has to do, generally understood, has to do with the fact that Messiah is going to come from this tribe. They recognize that Shiloh seems to be a name for Messiah in some way. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. That ultimately he is going to be the dominant force on all the planet. And that is set forth, say, in other prophetic passages that we saw, like in Daniel, where that stone cut out without hands becomes a great mountain. And it's indicative of the fact that Messiah appears in human history as maybe an insignificant figure. I mean, if you go back and you review human history at that time, Jesus was not the most significant person on the planet from the Roman perspective, say. Or even from the perspective of the Jews. There were people they thought were way more important. And so what started out as a very small, as seen in the parable of the mustard seed, grows to be a kingdom of immense proportions. And ultimately a worldwide kingdom, as we will see. So 24 here, the absence of Dan from this list is another problem that is generally explained by the fact that the Danites were heavily involved in idolatry. This is most people's suggestion when they deal with this passage as to why Dan is omitted. They say, well, Dan was a bad tribe. Well, if they were bad enough to be omitted from this list, then one should logically conclude that they're probably not going to be listed in the millennial situation either. I mean, if they're that bad. But the fact is, when you get into Ezekiel, Dan is mentioned as a viable tribe. So there has to be another reason, not just simply because they were idolaters at one time in their history. And idol worship, again, as we know, is simply putting something else in the place of God. In America today, we don't worship the Baals, per se. We worship a lot of other stuff. Judges 18 here, and then these went back into Micah's house and took the graven image, the ephod and the household idols and the molten image, and the priest said to them, What are you doing? And they said to him, be silent, put your hand over your mouth and come with us and be to us a father and a priest. We're starting our own religion, basically, is kind of the deal here. And obviously this is completely bogus, but one of the things that we've pointed out before is the Bible doesn't attempt to hide even the flaws of its greatest characters. So they said to him, be silent, put your hand over your mouth and come with us. It is better for you to be a priest to the house of one man or to be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel. Hey, a promotion. So this speaks to his STA grid, and he goes, whoopee, I'm getting a bigger church. Wow. And the priest's heart was glad, and he took the ephod and the household idols and the graven image and went among the people. And also 30 and 31, and the sons of Dan set up for themselves the graven image. Of course, this is all forbidden strictly under the Mosaic covenant to even have an image like this. You cannot represent the divine essence by any image. God is unique. He is spirit. He is invisible. You can't. How are you going to represent, say, even one attribute of God by drawing a picture of it? Well, draw me a picture that represents omnipresence. I'd like to see that one. That God is everywhere. Well, you can't do it, and so this was strictly forbidden, and this is all wrong, obviously, from the divine viewpoint. And Jonathan, the son of Gershob, the tribe of Manasseh, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's graven image, which he had made all the time that the house of God was at Shiloh. And that was one incident during the time of the judges. And that period of the judges, as we know, was a couple of hundred years from the time of the conquest, just after Joshua, which ended in about 1399 B.C., and goes down until we get into the time of Saul. And Saul reigned from about 1050 to 1010. So the time of the judges is that period in there between about 1399 and down to around 1050. Also, 1 Kings now, another passage. This was not an isolated incident in their history. That's another thing. 1 Kings 12. 28 through 30. So the king consulted and made two golden calves. And he said to them, it is too much for you to go to Jerusalem. It's too hard to go that far to worship God. You don't need to do it. Behold, your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt. And he set one up in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. So they were still engaged in this, again, during the time of the divided monarchy, which followed Solomon. And so now we're down past 970 B.C. We're later, much later than that. So this is an incident that happened several hundred years removed from the one in Judges. 25, several commentators mention the fact that Irenaeus, who was one of the patristics, one of the early writers following the death of all the apostles in the late 1st and 2nd century A.D., that this tribe had been omitted since the Antichrist would arise from it. Now, that's a fanciful interpretation, but it became accepted by a lot of people. That's the whole thing. This guy is a church father. His voice carries far more weight than other people's does. Really? Based on what? The fact that he lived closer to the apostles, so therefore he must know more? No. One of the things we see, that even the people under the apostles were very often maladjusted. I only can cite you the Corinthians and the Galatians as examples of that. And these characters that Paul names by name in his epistles, Alexander the coppersmith, say, for instance, certain people that loved the world, his name escaped me at the moment, but he loved the world and has forsaken me. Demas, I believe he was. We get to heaven, we'll see how Demas, oh, you're the guy that loved the world so much. Well, that'll be nice for him, won't it? Not really. Well, this is unsubstantiated and lacking in documentation. Again, people tend to put too much weight sometimes on history. This is very often seen in those that espouse the doctrine, say, of Lutheranism and Calvinism. Because these men were great theologians, and they said the final word on everything. No, they didn't. Who told you that? But people believe that. And so it becomes law, it becomes a tradition, and so then people just accept it without thinking. Well, there's no indication that the Antichrist comes from Dan, and in fact, he doesn't. But that's what some people believe. 26, the next issue is the inclusion of Levi. Now the answer, and I didn't put it in here, but hopefully you already know, the answer as to why Dan's not included is there aren't 12,000 positive Jews in that tribe at that time. That's the only reason. It's not that there aren't people on the earth from the tribe of Dan. It's not as though that tribe doesn't continue to exist. It does. It's just that there weren't people out of that tribe that could fulfill the bill here of what we need. The next issue is the inclusion of Levi, the priestly tribe of Israel, and the inclusion of Joseph and Manasseh. One of the things you should know is that in the land grant list, Levi was left out. They weren't given any land because they were to be priests, and so therefore they had to be all over Israel as they represented God and did his work and all that. Well, 27, Ephraim and Manasseh were the two sons of Joseph, and normally their inclusion in a list depended on whether or not Levi was mentioned. If Levi was omitted, point 28, Joseph was also omitted, and both Ephraim and Manasseh were included in the roster. Here, point 29, Levi is included with Joseph, while Manasseh seemingly replaces Dan. 30, some have attempted to explain this as a scribal error by suggesting that the abbreviations for Manasseh was somehow confused with Dan. Well, so they're saying this was abbreviated in the text. Number one, it's not. But the argument could be made, man and Dan look alike, and so somebody might have made an error. But that presupposes that this was abbreviated. And Manasseh was not abbreviated in the text. I've got my Greek Bible I can show you if you want to see it. So, again, there is no textual evidence for such a mistake. Some people say things and they say, well, perhaps this happened. Well, that didn't happen. Oh, well, okay, but what if it did? Well, why talk about it? It didn't happen. It wasn't there. So again, that's one explanation of why this is the way it is, but that's not satisfying. 31, while many have insisted on making more out of this than it says, the millennial division of the land, which occurs, following Daniel's 70th week, lists the following tribes: Dan, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Ephraim, Reuben, Judah, Benjamin, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun, Gad, and a portion for the priests and Levites. Now in that list, Joseph isn't mentioned, so are we supposed to assume the tribe of Joseph no longer exists? No, it's just not mentioned. And his two sons, both Ephraim and Manasseh, get his portion. It's divided up in that regard. So 32, therefore the only conclusion that should be drawn from the division of the 12 tribes is that these are the 12 groups that have exactly 12,000 men at that time, or at least have that many, who are sufficiently positive and will be selected to act as the Lord's special envoys during Daniel's 70th week. And this is, by all estimations, a tough job and in a difficult period of history. But they are up for it. Now, they're not up for it as of yet. And, of course, as we know, the prophecies in, say, Ezekiel 37... the prophecy about the dry bones, forecast a return to Israel in unbelief. And the physical return precedes the spiritual restoration. And so They are not going to spiritually get their act together until after they're there. And so this 144,000 in some ways is the fulfillment of the spiritual restoration, certainly the beginnings of that, that the remnant of Israel. And they're always mentioned, the positive volition is always mentioned as a remnant. It's never mentioned as the whole nation. Paul knew it wasn't the whole nation, and anybody that studies the Bible should know it's not the whole nation. It's a segment of positive volition that exists among Israel, and it's called true Israel for that reason. Because they are the ones who actually fulfill their mandate, as we pointed out. These begin to fulfill the mandate to be a light to the nations and effectively do what Israel was selected to do. So, this all, again, falls together very neatly. You don't have to stretch. You don't have to wrench the scripture till it screams. It works, and it fits, because it's correct. 33, while an individual tribe may be omitted from any list for whatever reason, it certainly appears that the 12 are intact during the millennium. 34, the passages in Ezekiel and Revelation certainly refute the deceptive notion that the 10 northern tribes of Israel have been lost. Now that's one of the things, if you study theology much or go out there and look around, people say, oh, the 10 northern tribes were lost after the Assyrian captivity. They never really were found again. Well, God knows where they are, I can tell you that much, and they certainly still do exist. But the counterpart doctrine to this, British Israelism, suggests that the Britons, and of course finally the Anglo-Saxons through America, are the 10 lost tribes. Now guess who else believes this? The Mormons. And people such as Herbert Armstrong and the Worldwide Church of God, these people are all big on British Israelism. And guess what? It's not true. The Brits are not the 10 lost tribes, and neither are we. But the 10 tribes moved to America, and then Joseph Smith ran into the angel moron, and he told him all about it. And anybody that believes that is dumb, 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 dumb. Well, that's the Mormon doctrine. And the angel shows up and gives him these 12 plates, or these golden plates, and then he can't find them anymore. Well, guess what? That doesn't work. All right, verse 9 now. After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one was able to count. After these things, again, is John's marker that he uses in here, preposition meta, plus the near demonstrative pronoun houtos. And after these things is simply just his way of advancing his chronology. He's not saying that he's necessarily advancing the chronology of Revelation. And in fact, though, what we are doing now is moving from the sealing of the 144,000, which occurs down here at the beginning of Daniel's 70th week, to this great multitude, which is seen at the end of Daniel's 70th week. And we've moved ahead chronologically in the text here, or in Daniel's 70th week, a space of about 7 years. But John is only saying this, again, after I saw the 144,000 sealed, then I saw this. I looked, aorist active indicative of the verb to see, eidon, and behold, interrogative, or rather here, an interjection, idu, which commands the reader to look and pay attention. Hey, this is unusual. This is a marker to get people's attention. And behold, a great multitude. Oklos means a crowd or a throng of people, O-C-H-L-O-S. And then you got the qualifying adjective, polis, great, much, or many. Here we would say a great multitude, a large crowd, is probably how we would say it in our vernacular. Which, relative pronoun host, referring back to Oklos, which crowd? No one. Number here, udais. Not one, literally. It's a compound from negative u and the number ice, one. No one was able. Imperfect deponent indicative of the verb to be, have power, to be able to do something, dunamai. No one was able to number. You have here a complementary infinitive, arithmeo. Obviously our word arithmetic. No one was able to number it. Literally here you have a redundant use of the pronoun autos. A large crowd which no one was able to number it. And again, it's not smooth English, but that's the way he said it in the Greek. From every nation. Again, you have the preposition ek here plus the adjective pos coupled with the noun ethnos. and it's a genitive singular here. Again, this construction of pas with an anarthrous substantive means every. Pas usually means all, each, or every, and context has to determine how you translate it. But strict rules of grammar govern this in the Greek, and first-year Greek students know this. From every nation. And now here you actually have a chi, which is not simply functioning as a connective. Because what you have is a singular here, from every nation, followed by a series of plurals, which are designed to qualify the phrase nation, from every nation. And so I would translate this here, including all. And they've just translated it, and all, but the idea here is including all tribes, which is phule again, we've seen that word before, and peoples, laos. These are smaller divisions, tribes, peoples, laos, and languages, glossa. Translated tongues, but the word tongues means languages. And so we see that in the thinking of John here, one of the things you can see is that the nation is the big division. There's nothing bigger than national entities. So much for the international conspiracy of the last days to get rid of national boundaries. It's not of God. And then in that, you have, in nations, you have various tribes and peoples and languages. See, unfortunately, we have various languages in America. I think we should speak English, but that's me. So you have smaller divisions within the nation. I saw people from all of these standing before the throne. Standing is a perfect active participle of histemi. And again, this participle here is plural because it really is the sense of you're talking about a lot of people, and so it's plural. But grammar-wise, it should be singular because it really is designed here to go with the word nation, from every nation. But because, you know, these nations consist of people, that's why it's a plural. In the presence of is before an opion, a preposition that takes the genitive, and then it's followed by the genitive of thronos, with the definite article, thronos. Standing before the throne and before the Lamb, and in the presence, chi here, connective, in the presence of the Lamb. Again, the little lamb, arnion, it's a diminutive. This word, the word for lamb itself is never used of Jesus in Revelation. It's always this word, the little lamb. And apparently this is one of the ways the Father expresses his affection towards the Son. It's his little lamb. And of course, as we saw, the ironies that this little lamb is fixing to wreak havoc upon planet Earth at the end of chapter 6 hide us from the wrath of the little lamb. People generally are not afraid of little lambs. You might be afraid of a ram if he came charging at you, but a little lamb wouldn't normally scare you. Well, this little lamb is the God-man in his glorified hypostatic union, and he is about to wreak havoc. But here, obviously, this group is favorably related to him. Now, the question was asked at the end of chapter 6, who can stand before him in this great day of wrath? Well, these people are standing before him. And all it takes is positive volition of God consciousness. All you got to do is want a relationship with him. He will provide everything necessary. That's the nature of grace. So standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes. Perfect middle participle, a periballo, which literally means this is a compound to cast around, and that's how you put your clothes on. You kind of throw them around you. This is plural also, which indicates all the peoples out there. It's a middle. The middle, just in the Greek language, the middle says that the verb, the subject, not only performs the action, he participates in the results. So like when you clothe yourself, you are clothed, but you're the one that did it. I assume you dressed yourself this morning. And if you dressed yourself, then you did it in the middle voice in the Greek. So, having clothed themselves, some have suggested that this is a passive, but I don't see it as that. One, it's not parsed as a passive. Having clothed themselves with robes, white. Again, stole is the verb or the noun here, S-T-O-L-E. And then the qualifying adjective of leukos, an outer garment or a robe of what, shining or white. And, again, connective chi, and phoenix is the noun here. Palm branches, P-H-O-I-N-I-X. Three times this word is used, and it means exactly that. Palm branches in their hands. End with the allocative of the genitive plural of kyre, the word for hands, and then the genitive of autos, in the hands of them. And they cry out with a loud voice, saying, salvation or deliverance to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And as kai, they cry out. This actually means to cry out, to scream, or to shout. So this is a loud ovation here. This is not a quiet thing. And it's a present active indicative. They are crying out. John like puts himself, he's trying to put the reader right in the moment as he was standing there seeing this large group crying out, screaming, literally, before the throne. They cry out or they shout with a loud voice. Again, the adjective megas, when qualifying the word phone, voice, we translate it loud. It means great or loud. Saying, present active participle here giving us the content, lego, the salvation or the deliverance. Definite article, hey plus soteria. This word, sozo, the verb means to save. Soteria means an act of saving or an act of delivering. And in this case, it refers to a huge acts of deliverance, as we will see. The salvation to our God. There is no verb, so they just simply belongs, you might supply in there. Salvation comes from or belongs to. It's pretty flexible here because you don't have a verb. Salvation to our God. The word theos with the definite article. To our God, the one sitting, definite article plus the participle here functioning as a substantive, the present passive participle of kathemai, the one sitting upon the throne. And, while not repeated, the word salvation here, and salvation belongs to the Lamb, to the little Lamb. To arnion. All right, well, our time's up this session. We'll have to continue on there. Let's go ahead and take our normal 20-minute break, and we'll pick up here at 5 after.